It's the Power Trip After Party Podcast on iHeartRadio.
Thanks for joining. This is the Power Trip After Party Podcast. We know you're in town for shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Would have been super awesome to meet you in person on Friday, but it looks like this is the only way we could get you. But, man, we'll take it because we're all gigantic fans, so we appreciate the time.
If you come to the show, we can hang backstage after the show one night. But I know you're probably exhausted from it all. But
yeah, I don't know. You know, getting up every day to do morning radio is not the end of the world. But what's the schedule of a stand-up comedian? Like, you have shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Pantages. Give me your standard Minneapolis day when you're in a different city. Do you nap during the day? What do you do?
You know what? It's so funny. It's sort of boring. I try to walk the city as much as I can, but as you know, Minneapolis in February is. It's probably cautionary day to day, right?
Sure. We do have a great Skyway system, though.
Yes, I know.
Which is huge. System. Yeah.
Honestly, I go to coffee shops. I write, you know, I go to museums if they're nearby. I think about the show. Like, I've been working on this show for about 3 years now. It's called The Old Man in the Pool. It's all about sort of death and middle age and mortality. And I really I just think about the show all day. I write my notebook and that's sort of my existence.
Well, let me start with that then, because I'm a huge fan of your podcast. And one of the things that I love about it is your genuine love for other joke writers and comedians. I mean,
it's
obviously you're not hiding the fact that, that you love joke writing and you have so much respect for other joke writers. And not just the finished product. Clearly, the whole point of calling the thing working it out is you just love the process. And it sounds like that consumes a good chunk of your life.
Yeah. I think, honestly, because when I started when I was so young, like I started in Washington, D.C. when I was 19. And it was, I won a comedy contest at college. And then the prize, two prizes. One was a big check that was for... You know those big checks? I don't even know if they still do that anymore. Like 5 feet long. And it was for $200, which is definitely more money than it cost to print that check. And then also it was to do a show, to open for somebody at the Washington, D.C. Improv, which is a great club. And it was actually long before he exploded, but it was for Dave Chappelle. That was the first person I opened for them. And then I got hooked. Like I got a job working the door at the Washington, D.C. Improv. And then it was like, well, this is all I want to do. And so I became obsessed with just jokes and writing jokes.
When you got that opportunity to do the, you know, working at the improv and getting and being able to open, how long did you how long was your set?
Oh, my gosh. It's so funny. You know, you're right. You write like 4 or 5 hours. I always say this to young comics, like you write 4 or 5 hours to like have 5 minutes sort of thing. I think I thought I had a lot more time than I had. I think I had when I was starting out, I think I probably had like 5 minutes that worked and I had like 15 minutes that really didn't work, but I was throwing it on stage.
Right. And those 5 minutes could be a minute if it didn't go well. Those five minutes could be 25 if it went well. That's the beauty of doing it.
No, it's unbelievable. It's so audience can, all this stuff is so audience contingent. If you get a flow with an audience, you find yourself doing, you know, 20 minutes from, you know, from five. But like, yeah, that's one of the strange things about comedy is that how much the audience is a participant in the of what happens.
So how much of the art of joke writing did you study, or is it all just kind of stuff you figured out on the fly? Like, is that something you studied in college, or is that just a process that it's just trial by fire?
It's trial by fire, and it's all honestly like asking comedians for advice who I open for. So like I would ask like Mitch Hedberg, who I know is a Minnesota native, and we sadly lost, but I would ask George Lopez, Kathleen Madigan, like all these comics who would come through, I would like hit them up for advice. And in hindsight, I know that I was probably completely and totally annoying. But at the time I was just soaking it up. And, you know, like I remember one time I said Like George, like it was always like advice from like the most unexpected places. Like I remember one time I used to have a joke about Oprah because in the 90s, Oprah had this theme song where she was like, I don't know if you'd remember this. This might be before your time, but she had a song that was like, run on, run on. It was like, and I had this joke. It was like, I don't think Oprah's running anywhere. And George Lopez said to me this thing backstage is so true. He goes, if I were you, I wouldn't make fun of Oprah early in your set. They like Oprah more than they like you.
Brilliant.
They don't know who you are.
That's probably a good lesson.
Yeah, so he was like, make fun of yourself. It was funny. It was the first person who was like, you should make fun of yourself. And I've become known as like a self-deprecating comic. And actually like a part of it is from just doing those shows and being that first slot. The first slot in the comedy show, as you know, like is just hard. It's just, you got to dig out the audience from complete silence and like eating into like thinking it, feeling like they're at a comedy show.
I'm sorry. I'm Chris. It's an honor to have you on the show. Thank you. We were running late. I had some things to do after the show, and I ran in here as quickly as I could. I'm not sure if they addressed this, but on the way in, I was listening to an old podcast you did in 2017, I should say, with John Mulaney, where you listened to your old comedy albums and you talked about it. That was great. And I'm a huge fan. But a couple of things about that interview that I found really, really fascinating. Number one was how much you helped him early in his comedy career in ways that I would never think of. And my favorite one was that you just told him one day, you got to get better.
Yeah, that's actually a true story. Because it was like, because he was fresh out of college. He was like 22. He was like 22 years old. I mean, I posted a photo of that era of me and John together like a few years ago on social media, but like he was so young. Cause like he looks young now. He looks young now and he's in his 30s. Like when he was 22, he looked like he was 9 years old, just like traveling the country. And I was just like, we'd be playing like Penguins Comedy Club in Cedar Rapids or something like that. And I would bring him along and I'd just be like, well, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you have to get better if I'm going to bring you, or else, like, I look stupid for bringing you. And so he just wrote a ton of jokes. Like, he just wrote his butt off. And then, like, and then, of course, you know, cut to he's one of our great comics.
So you mentioned Hedberg earlier, too. And obviously, Hedberg had... the cadence or the kind of cadence where he could read the phone book and you'd probably laugh. It doesn't matter what he says. You have a very distinct style as well. You have these kind of long, drawn out sentences. It's a very obviously intentional pace, right? And then the end of your sentences, which is almost always the punchline, you don't have to scream it or like punch it in our face. A lot of times you just kind of leave the words there. How calculated when you're writing jokes do you have to have your own cadence in mind, like knowing the kind of jokes you can land with the way that you deliver the lines?
Well, it's funny because like Mitch, for example, like I early on in my career, I was such a big fan of Mitch that like many of my fellow comics, I was just sort of ripping off Mitch's cadence early on. You know, like he has that very clear, like, I'm pretty good at tennis, but I will never be as good as the wall. The wall is relentless. All right. You know, and brilliant. And I would do my jokes in that cadence. Cause I just thought like, well, that's the best way to do comedy. You know what I mean? And we won't name names, but a lot of people did that and still do. So influential. And then over time, I sort of figured out, like, the thing that you're talking about of me, like, sort of having, like, a slow drawl, it's like, that's just sort of how I talk. And so it was, I feel like a lot of stand-up comedy is like any expertise, whether it's radio or, film or like, anything, is you get comfortable with being yourself eventually. Like, if you do something for enough hours, after a while, you pretend to fake it.
Was that?
I'm sorry. You. I should say, after a while, you forget to fake it. You know what I mean? Like, we all have these, like, walls up of, like, no, I'm this. And it's, like, after a certain point, like, you're just, like, I'm exhausted. I guess I'll just be myself.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. How long into that, into your starting your career in comedy, did it take you to get to that? Where you were, like, well, when I'm just myself, I'm a lot funnier than doing other people's cadence. Or maybe you get, you know, somebody else you like as a comic. You're, like, I kind of like the way they do it. I'm not going to intentionally rip it off, but I'm going to kind of copy the way they do it. How long into your career did it take you just to be like, I'm funnier when I'm just me?
God, I want to say it was like 7 years, maybe 6 years. It takes so long. There's all these different theories on sort of how long it takes to become yourself as a stand-up comic. I remember opening for Jake Johansson when early on in my career, one of my favorite comics, and he said 7 years, and I find that to be pretty accurate to what I've seen. But it's funny because, like, some people never find it. You know what I mean? Like, there's still people doing Mitch Hedberg in a club right now as we speak somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, that's a very common one. By the way, I was tweeting. Did you see I tweeted about how Minnesota comedy is, I mean, it's probably no mystery why it's so good. But you got Hedberg, you got Bamford, you got Swartzen, I threw in Bob Dylan because I think Bob Dylan's one of the funniest writers ever.
Yeah.
And some people think I'm joking. I'm like, no, those lines are just ice cold funny, especially those early, you know, the albums in the 60s. But like, and so many others. I mean, when I posted that, people were like, what about this person? And I'm like, oh yeah, that person too.
Well, is it true? Are you friends with Mary Mack?
Mary Mack is brilliant.
See, we love Mary. She's been on the show a billion times, and we're friends with her as well. We love her. I think she's originally from Wisconsin, I think.
Yeah, that's correct.
She lives here, though. But, yeah, I mean, we have great venues here. Pantages is great, but obviously we have Acme. Have you played Acme in the past or not?
Love Acme. Yeah, I love Acme. I played Acme early on in my career. I played Acme, I want to say, like 4 or 5 times. I mean, is Lewis still there?
I believe so.
I mean, Lewis is so smart. I mean, that's one of the things about that club and like, and then Minneapolis in general, in terms of a comedy scene, is it's a much smarter comedy scene than your typical like American city comedy scene, because it's a combination of things that seemingly happen. You got the audiences are really smart because it's Minneapolis, and then you got Lewis came in, who's really smart, and is like, you know what? I'm not going to book sort of hacky acts here. I'm going to book really good acts. And so he brought in people like, you know, like Bamford or Jimmy Pardo or, you know, Mitch Hedberg. He would have a lot early on. And he just sort of, Todd Glass works Acme a lot, who's a riot. one of my favorites. Another one who influenced me a lot, Todd Glass.
He's super funny.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is? When I was opening for him at the DC Improv way back, and I don't do this, but it completely left an imprint on me. In the middle of the show, he just starts eating someone's chicken fingers from the front row of the show as though it's not happening. Like, literally just starts eating them and talking, doing his bits and not acknowledging it. And I thought it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen anyone do. And I just thought, like, that there are, like, the lesson of it was, like, there are no rules in this sport.
Well, and interesting transition, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about is you do so many different things, obviously movies, one-man show, books, and stand-up comedy. How do you decide where to put your attention?
Oh my God. This is the hardest challenge, is figuring out, like, where to focus my attention. I think, it's a great question. I mean, I made two feature films, Sleepwalk With Me and Don't Think Twice. I'm writing my third one right now. I'm jonesing to finish it, but I'm writing the show that I'm performing in Minneapolis, which is called The Old Man and the Pool. And so that's sort of not holding me back, but that's getting my attention right now because I'm on the road and all this stuff. And I mean, to get really grim about it, it's like we only have so many years in our lives.
Yeah, right.
And so, it's just sort of, honestly, it's like what gets your attention. It's like what in a given day, it's sort of like, well, what makes me excited that day? And I feel like the old man in the pool is all about like sort of life and death and mortality and the things that we say and don't say to each other and all that kind of thing. And like, I feel like with the pandemic, it's been one of those things where because there's so much sort of death and virus and all this stuff around us, it's felt urgent to sort of get out there and just like make people laugh and just say like, I appreciate you basically.
Yeah.
And obviously your success has earned you that freedom, right? To decide what kind of time you want to spend on what. And that goes all the way back to, and this is what I wanted to ask you about is your internship to start this thing all off was with Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
And your podcast, Working It Out with Conan, was awesome because to be an intern on that show, when you were an intern on the show, right? Like, this is 90s Conan, yeah, where he was doing crazy
yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
And again, I'm 41 years old, so I grew up worshiping Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, I'm 43. We're in the same boat.
So I can't imagine what your head was doing when you got an internship working for him when you got that. That must have been awesome. But now, in 2022, and I think the podcast was, what, last summer or last year or something, but we're talking 2021 at that point, and you guys were equals. I mean, it's cool that, like, you know, he has so much respect for you. You have so much respect for him. And 25 years ago, you were just an intern trying to make it, and now you're doing podcasts together.
It's mind-bending. I have to remind myself of it all the time because Conan, it's funny how generationally, like, I have, like, David Cross I interviewed for the podcast. And that's coming up in like a couple of weeks. And the youngest person on our staff is 21, Working It Out. And the oldest person is 62. And what's amazing is someone like David Cross, you know, the older end of the spectrum, we're like, Mr. Show. You know what I mean? Like, we're like, it's legendary. And then the younger end of the spectrum is like Arrested Development, you know? And it's just amazing how, you know, Conan, like, to the generation now, they're like, I love Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend podcast. But like, to our generation, we're like, his show in the 90s literally broke every rule of late night television and sort of reinvented the form. And it's just all cyclical truly like such an honor to like to talk to Conan and have him treat me with any semblance of friendliness at all.
And the other thing, too, that a lot of people know is he wrote arguably one of the best Simpsons episodes ever in the monorail episode that people absolutely love. He wrote on that show, and that show is still going on, which is an incredible thing.
And, like, peak era SNL.
Correct, yeah.
Like, some of that stuff. Yeah, no, the SNL, yeah, that Simpsons stuff he wrote, I mean, he's a living legend. He's a living legend of comedy. And it's extraordinary. I mean, I feel like, to your point about like, where do you spend your time? Like, I feel like similarly as a comedy fan, it's like there's so much stuff to consume. There's so much great stuff. And it's like, you wake up and you're just like, well, where do I begin with all this stuff?
Zach, I'm sure you got a question if you want to jump in and just talk.
Yeah. I mean, I just was wondering, I mean, we mentioned earlier about all the stuff that you have to do. Is it tough to come up with ideas when you're so busy with all these other projects and everything else? How do you find the time to actually, you know, build your material?
Well, it's I honestly like coming to Minneapolis is helpful for me because I have a 6.5-year-old daughter. So when I'm home, it's like family time, and then there's, you know, work time, and then there's shows. And when I'm in Minneapolis, it's like, it'll be like, I walk around, you know, in the subterranean tunnels and go to comedy shops. And that, honestly, that's when the material comes to me. And it's also, honestly, it's just living. It's like, literally, like, you know, it's all you got to fall down the stairs to have a story about falling down the stairs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, life is show prep.
It's
right?
A great line.
Yeah, one of the other things that would frighten me beyond belief about being a stand-up comic would be the idea that you almost can't help but steal bits from people. And I would guess, is that a a constant fear. Do you ever write a joke and then spend the next hour saying, did I just steal that from somebody?
I've definitely Googled jokes that I've written and gone, like, somebody must have written that before. You know, like, I have a joke in my new show. I go, I always dread going to my annual physical because I have a lot of pre-existing conditions, which I call conditions, because everything is existing if it does, and everything is pre unless it happened just now. And I was like, somebody must have written something like that. And I Googled it, didn't find anything on it. So
what happens if you Google something and it's somebody has it in a kind of a different narration? Do you just completely scrap the whole thing?
Yeah. No, it's years ago. It's funny. My brother Joe and I collaborate on writing sometimes. And Joe pitched a joke years ago. He goes, they say laughter is the best medicine, but I think medicine is pretty good too, you know? And I was like, that's a great joke. And then I Googled it, and it was like, I think, speaking of Minnesota, like, I think Franken might've written a similar joke, or like, a really big comic wrote something almost identical. And so then, yeah, you scrap it. You just keep moving. But yeah, that's all you can do.
Well, let me ask about, this is a long-winded question. Stay with me for a second. But I had a friend in high school that she used to do storytelling competitions, you know, state tournament and things. She was, one of the better storytellers in the state. And I used to think to myself, like, what the hell is she going to do with this, though, the rest of her life, if this is like her passion? And then she went to college for some other things, and now she does these giant corporate speeches all over the world. She's flying all over the place. It's crazy. And she's made a career now out of storytelling in a corporate world, right? Like how your business can tell stories. And I'm like, look at her flipping storytelling into money. And obviously you're known as a storyteller comedian, right? And I'm not trying to get you to throw anybody under the bus, but the people that don't like Dane Cook say, well, where are the jokes? He's just a storyteller. He's just a very animated storyteller. You're obviously both, right? You are telling stories that have jokes, right?
Yeah.
You obviously have a lot of passion for the storytelling part of it. You've made a career out of being a really good storyteller. Where does that love of storytelling come from? And then how did you realize that maybe that was your niche, right? That was the difference between you and other stand-up comedians?
Well, my first love is jokes. And so, like, if you listen to the stories, like, on My Girlfriend's Boyfriend or Thank God for Jokes, like everything. I mean, there's a joke every 30 seconds in the shows. But then what happened was, is like, it must have been like around 2003, I was asked to tell a story for the Moth Radio Hour, you know, the Moth. At the time, it wasn't a public radio show or anything. It was a local storytelling show here. And they asked me to tell a story, and I told this story that ended up being in My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. It's a totally true story where, sorry, there's drilling here. It's not mine drill. It's someone else's drill. It's New York City. This is the nature of New York all the time. Is like, there's literally just construction around us constantly. Oh my God. Let me know if that gets too much, and then
I can't hear it.
No, okay, cool. So 2003, I get asked to tell a story, and I told this story about how when I was in high school, I had my first girlfriend, and the only caveat was that she told me that I couldn't tell anyone that she was my girlfriend, and I was like, all right, you know, I totally get that, you know what I mean, like. And then she invites me to meet her parents, and I go to her house. I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, this is going to be like a big life moment for me. And I go and I meet her. The part I left out is she told me I couldn't tell people that she was my girlfriend because she had another boyfriend, but it was ending. You know what I mean? Like, it was in the process of like falling away. And so I was like, all right, you know, as long as that's falling away, that's fine. And so she invites me to meet her parents, and I'm like, this is the vindication that I need. And I go, I meet her parents. And then this other guy comes over, and it's slowly dawning on me, like, this is the other boyfriend, and I'm hanging out with my girlfriend's boyfriend. This is a totally true story. And then he suggests that we go hang out at his house, and I met his parents. And he goes, it's truly demoralizing meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend's parents for the first time, because part of you is upset about it, and then part of you like still wants to make a good impression. You know, you're like, maybe if this really goes well, you know, that kind of. And that was like the first story I told. And I got to say, like, when I told that, it's and it like rolls off me now. Like, I don't care about telling that story. I'm not embarrassed about it anymore. It's like 30 years ago. But at the time when I told it, like, we still have the audio recording. Like, I was quivering telling that story. Like, quivering. Like, I'm like almost choked up, because there's something about storytelling where if you tell an embarrassing story, fundamentally, the first few times you tell it, you're like, I do not want to tell this to strangers. Like, I have like four or five stories in my new show where I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to say this tonight. You know what I mean? Like, I have something, my last show is called The New One, and it's on Netflix if people want to see it. But like, it was all about having a child. It's all about how I never wanted to have a child. That's what the whole first half of the show is. And the second half of the show is how I had a child. And how I was right, and then ultimately how I was wrong, and then that becomes like the emotional part. But there's this point in the show where I confess something to the audience. I go, like, at my lowest point, at my like dark night of the soul moment of being a parent, I had this thought, like, I get why dads leave. And I go, I'm not gonna leave, but for the first time in my life, like, I get it. I'm not gonna do it, but I get it. And the first time I said that on stage was like probably at the Comedy Cellar in New York. It was like the laughter was like explosive, and it was crazy. But I was like, I'm really going to have to dig myself out of that. The ending of this show better get me the hell out of this proclamation, because, you know, my daughter is going to see this someday, and I have to make her know she's loved, and that like we all go through these ups and downs, and we experience like dark thoughts. I mean, that's the thing. Whenever people criticize comedy being dark, you know, like some of my favorite standups are like Doug Stanhope. Like, I love, you know, Doug Stanhope, but a lot of folks who like people view as dark. And I'm like, there's nothing wrong with dark. What's, you know, dark helps us understand what's light, you know, it helps us understand, you know, what it feels like to be in a dark place. And hopefully my shows do this. This is at least the goal, is that it goes to the dark place and then it arrives at a place where you go, all right, well, that's okay. Like, that's all right. We can, you know, we can work with that kind of thing. And that's what that show is all about. And this show is all about that, sort of with life and death, actually.
You talk about the journey that you take people on in your show. What's your favorite part of the journey each night when it comes to stand up?
So my favorite part is that the audience is literally different every night. And so you actually don't, when you walk out of that stage, you do not have any idea what that audience is going to be.
Even at this stage of your career.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. I did a show in New York last night, and it's weird in New York because this is where I live. And so people come, you know, I have the podcast that's working it out. It's working out process. And so like, I have people who come like 3, 4, 5 times to the same show. And so they know the jokes. And so they're not going to really laugh at the jokes, but they'll laugh at like new taglines or new stories and things like that. And so it's like really rough terrain in terms of like understanding, okay, how do I, Brian Regan, one of the great comics, I think, like he says this great line. He goes, the job of the comedian is to walk out on stage and take a group of people and turn them into an audience.
Wow. Yeah. Mm. That's tough.
It's so hard.
Is there any thing that you do outside of stand-up comedy that gets you that rush? Like, does serious acting or the one-man shows? Is there anything else? Do you feel that in your life besides that first couple moments on stage?
I had that with... when I directed the movie Don't Think Twice with Keegan-Michael Key and Gillian Jacobs, which is, if people haven't seen it, I think it's on Peacock right now. It's streaming at a bunch of different places, but it's all about this group of best friends. It's like me and Chris Gethard and Keegan-Michael Key and Gillian Jacobs and Tammy Sager and Kate Micucci. And we're all in myself, and we're all in an improv group, and we're best friends. And then Keegan gets cast, his character gets cast on like a Saturday Night Live-esque show, and then everybody else doesn't. And it's about what happens in life when you realize this thing that I realized in my 20s at a certain point, which is like not everybody gets the same thing. Like that's not how it goes down. And so it's sort of like this bittersweet comedy. But it was funny because we made this, you know, 5 years ago. And for like a couple months, we became a fake improv troupe. Like we performed at Upright Citizens Brigade and People's Improv Theater. And like we would do shows. And it was like a time machine because it was like going back into my 20s when I was doing improv and stuff and like living out this experience of like, oh my God, these are my best friends. And we do improv every night. And it was like, the movie has like fun cameos. Like, Ben Stiller makes a cameo as himself. And all of us are really like nervous because he shows up at the bar and everyone's sort of stepping on each other to talk to Ben Stiller and stuff. And it was just one of those things where I was like, I got to make a movie. I've always loved movies. Like I love movies and I love TV, but I love movies even more. And I was like, I got to make the movie that was in my head, which is a kind of a crazy thing. If you know, is any kind of like a dream coming to fruition. If you build houses, you build sculptures, whatever you do, like if you have an idea in your head and then you can make it into something, like that's such a privilege. That's a crazy privilege.
You talked earlier when we first started about how you won that college comedy bit. What was your actual big break? Was there a moment where you were like, all right, I've worked hard, I've written all these jokes, I've got all these hours of jokes, I've got my material, where you thought to yourself, man, I can literally do this for a living?
I think, you know what's funny is early on, I had that sense when I was at the Washington, D.C. Improv. It's funny because like you'd think it would be like later in my career, like making movies or you know, being on Orange is the New Black or being in Trainwreck or some of these like bigger sort of high profile things. But I actually think like it was more early on when I was like, they'll pay me $40 to perform stand-up comedy.
Right.
Sold. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I can drive 7 hours to Dayton, Ohio, and they'll pay me $35 and a cheeseburger to do stand-up comedy. Count me in. Like, it's great. Like, I honestly got more of a rush just from the idea of like, you gotta be kidding me that this could be your job. I was like, I used to have a calendar where it'd be like Dayton, Ohio, Cincinnati, you know, like, you know, Duluth, whatever the city was. And it would be like, and I would put in parentheses next to it, like how much money I would make for that week. And most of the weeks it'd be like 250 or like in parentheses, like 300 or like 200. And I would be doing the math of all of those to hopefully have it add up to $1,200 so that I could pay my rent. And then hopefully, like, you know, there were days in Queens when I would like live on like a slice of pizza for a day. And like that was honestly like I was like pretty happy about that. And then in terms of like a big break that like actually was life changing, like I did Letterman when I was young. I did Letterman when I was 24. And that was a thing where all of a sudden at comedy clubs, not the biggest comedy clubs, but some of the smaller comedy clubs would be like, okay, you know, we can have him because he has a TV credit. And so that was when I could start doing 45 minutes or an hour. And that changed everything, because to your question earlier about stories, you know, you can't really tell stories if you have a 15-minute slot on a show. But if you have an hour, you can tell some stories.
Which brings to mind something I heard on that podcast you were talking about. You were talking about how you tell young comedians, if your joke, write your joke out. If it's 45 words, let me hear that joke in 15 words.
Yeah.
That makes your job so much harder, though.
Yeah, it does. But like, man, look at Hedberg.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Like those jokes are just, I mean, can I curse on here?
Of course.
Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah.
He's like, literally one of his jokes is like, I want to play Little League now. I kick some fucking ass, you know? And it's like, that joke is like 9 words.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know that, like, that's just trial and error. That's just like him throwing up the version that's probably 30 words and being like, could I say it quicker? What about 20? You know, can I say it quicker? I don't know if he was that mathematical about it, but I think that was in his calculation in his head.
Hey, if I could talk about spreading your wings a little bit. You mentioned a bunch of other projects you were in that weren't necessarily comedic, and one of the ones that caught me off guard, I'm a fan of Billions. It's the fun version of Succession, right? Succession, outside of like Cousin Greg, Succession's heavy, but Billions doesn't take itself as seriously, especially with the way they write for wags and characters like that. Yeah. So I forget, it was season 3 or 4, whatever season you jumped on. I didn't know you were going to be on the show, and here comes Mike Birbiglia, and I'm going, all right, they're going to have Birbiglia do something funny. And then, of course, Oscar was the opposite, right? Like, you get in the mix with Taylor. It was definitely a...
serious.
Yeah, it was a serious kind of like, a structure change for you. And I think because it was Billions... I think it was kind of fun to flip the audience that is familiar with you on its head a little bit and go, no, we're not going to let him do the jokes. We're doing serious stuff with Birbiglia. And it was awesome. Yeah. I thought you did a great job.
Thanks. Yeah, that was Brian Koppelman's been a friend of mine for a long time. And he created the show, and he actually did stand up like a long time ago. And he hangs at the Comedy Cellar in New York. And he was just like, would you want to play this part as like a venture capitalist? And we'll sort of write it around you a little bit, and you'll play opposite Asia Kate Dillon, and so I was like, yeah, let's give that a shot. And it's such a great time. And Paul Giamatti is amazing. I mean, the actors on that show are incredible, and the writing's great. And it's a serious thing. And I think it's not announced, but I'm doing it. I'm acting in an exciting film next month, which is I'll tell you about next time I'm in town. But it's I've been lucky, I've been lucky to end up in some decent things, you know, like I did a few seasons on Orange Is the New Black, and I was on Trainwreck. I was in Fault in Our Stars, which is absurd because I had no idea that was going to be this sort of international phenomenon movie.
You made us both cry.
Both of us cried. Yeah. Yes.
As you just said, a friend of yours was with the show Billions. How many times in the world of entertainment does that happen where instead of like a talent agent or your agent gets a hold of you and is like, hey, it's just somebody you knew from like 20 years ago is starting a show and they're like, hey, you know what'd be perfect for this? My boy Mike would be great for this. How many times does that happen in your world?
I think it happens. I mean, like, it's like, you know, the cliche about show business is like it's all about who you know or whatever, and it's like sort of, but also you get to decide who you know. You know what I mean? Like you get, you know, and if you, I feel like if you stay, like none of this stuff was happening in my 20s. Like if you stick around a scene long enough. Like I've been in New York for 22 years. Eventually you sort of meet a lot of people and you figure out who you have stuff in common with and who you're friends with. And like Brian and I, gosh, Brian had given me notes on my screenplay for Don't Think Twice. And I had given him notes on like an early, he showed me the pilot to Billions. That was before I was on the show. And he was like, do you have any thoughts on this? It was like a test screening. So we were like just sort of artistically friendly. And then that was like, I think season 2, he was like, would you want to do this? I was like, oh yeah, that sounds fun.
You mentioned life and death as a theme in your show. There's been a lot of death in the comedy world recently. Louis,
oh my God.
Saget, yeah. Norm as well. Any of those guys impact you at all, and what was your reaction to their passings?
I mean, it's unspeakable. I mean, how many deaths we've sustained in comedy lately? It's because there's usually a lot because it's a very wild bunch of folks who inhabit the comedy space, and so it's a lot of people who sort of, you know, live some people who live hard and so we lose people. We lost the great Greg Giraldo. We lost Mitch Hedberg. We lost Patrice, you know, like there's a lot of people we've lost over the years. And then, yeah, the Saget thing is just like, oh my God. I mean, I never met him personally, but I've sort of messaged with him a bit over the years and it was devastating. And then Norm had written like a really nice thing to me once, like, hey, I really enjoy your stuff. Like, I hope we can meet someday. And then I hear about that. He's like one of my favorite comics of all time. And then I see that and you just go, wow. I mean, that's the part of the reason why my show is about what my show is about, which is that I feel like you hit, you know, I'm 43. Like you hit this certain age and you go like, this is it. This is it. This is what we figure out what you're going to do because this is it.
Man, I know we said we'd let you go about 9:45 here as we're recording this, so we'll just keep you for a couple more minutes. But speaking of podcasts, since we do a podcast, this podcast, one thing that I was impressed with when I started listening to Working It Out is that you're very good at commercial reads. And that's not, again, as we've been doing this for decades, that's a skill that I don't think the average person thinks is easy. You just get on and talk about a product. But for somebody, I don't know your background, if you've done a lot of radio in the past, but man, your commercial reads are smooth for a guy that didn't seem to me to be a guy that was going to be just knocking them out of the park. You're super smooth.
Well, part of it, I appreciate it. And I'll put you in touch with my advertisers so you can tell them. But it'll go a long way. No, it's honestly like a majority of the companies that advertise with Working It Out, are companies I reached out to, like Spindrift and Bombas. I was just like, I like what they have. So I don't mind talking about them. You know, like it was funny because I think I remember hearing like MeUndies on like Bill Burr's podcast and just being like, they say they're soft. They say they're the softest ever.
Yeah, I have mine right now. They're great.
Yeah, exactly.
I do. Yeah, they're the best.
No, completely. And I remember Bill doing the read and going, he's like, they're the most comfortable on the web. You know, and I was like, well, he seems convinced by that, you know. And so I was like, I'll try them. This is before I had them as an advertiser. I was like, no, these are comfortable. And I hate shopping. I hate shopping. So I'm like, okay, that's the underwear for the rest of my life. And so then I'm like, okay, now I have a podcast. I'm just going to call them and tell them, like, I want to do ads for. And so, like, at least half of them, the ads on my show are for things I use. And, like, I ask them to be an advertiser.
Yeah, it makes it way more genuine, way more believable. That's awesome.
I appreciate it.
One last thing real quick, if you don't mind. Oh, yeah. We talked about Mulaney and you, and also Nick Kroll was a part of that.
Oh, yeah.
And Nick Kroll
was in that comedy competition, by the way, that I was first
And
at.
You told that story, and I was going to ask you if you wouldn't mind, because I was trying to relay it to these guys, but if you have stories about Nick Kroll, we're such huge fans of all three of you guys.
Nick Kroll is a mensch. He's an all-timer. He's like one of the best people I've ever encountered. He and I were in the comedy competition at college and we had never met, and he had this bizarre, the premise of his bit was that he was so nervous to do stand-up comedy that he was going to pee himself. And so he rigged a bag of water into his pants. And then in the middle of it, he reached in his pocket while doing stand-up, reached into his pocket and put a pin into the bag, and so the water would come out and it would look like he's peeing himself. Didn't work. The bag didn't pop, and then he's telling the audience that it's not working and that what was supposed to happen was that it was supposed to look like he's peeing himself. Which, if can you imagine being in that audience and you're just going, wait a minute, this person is telling me about a visual gag that isn't working. But then weirdly, like, he was killing with it. And my girlfriend at the time, Maggie, she goes like, because I didn't see it, she goes, you got to see the tape of this guy, Nick, because this dude is so funny. He is failing flamboyantly on stage and it's killing. And I watched the tape and I was like, oh my God, this person is funny. This is a Todd Glass-ism. Todd Glass always goes, is he funny in his bones? You know, he always goes like, I don't care. I don't care if he's funny. Is he funny in his bones? You know, and that's like a real Todd Glass-ism. But Nick is funny in his bones. And so I went up to him on campus and I was like, hey man, I'm in the improv group. And, you know, I would love it if you try out for the group. I feel like you're hilarious. And he goes, yeah, I was thinking of joining that. And I was like, well, it's an audition thing, but, you know, we'd love to have you try. And so then he auditioned for the group and we worked together for a few years. And are you there?
Yeah. No, we're still here. Yep.
Okay. We worked together for a few years. And then, gosh, he actually was nice enough. He put me in his movie Adult Beginners, which is a really good movie. And, it's just a little, cameo part, but yeah, he's a great guy. I mean, when we were in college, I mean, one of the things that young comics always say to me is like, how do you get on stage? And like, honestly, like how do you get stage time? And it really comes down to like, I would take any stage time. Like when Nick and I were in college, we would do anything. Like we hosted like an a cappella festival in college together. And at the half, at the intermission of the a cappella festival, he has a joint and he goes, hey, do you want to smoke this? And I was like, sure. And it's in hindsight, such a massive mistake. Because I'm the worst person to smoke pot with. I'm the person when you smoke pot with, who's just like, do you guys hate me? Like, why does my heart hurt? Do I have rickets? You know, like, I'm just not a fun hang. And so we smoked pot. And I think I had one drag. I don't even think I had two drags. And we got back on stage after the intermission. And I didn't know where I was. I didn't know I was a stand-up comedian. I didn't know any, and I'm looking at the audience and I'm waiting for them to talk to me.
Brilliant.
And oh, and this is what Nick always points out. Like I was wearing like a space helmet and like some kind of like wetsuit or something. Like I had found a costume backstage and I just put it on. And it was just like, you know, trial by fire. You learn your lessons sometimes the right way, sometimes the wrong way.
Man, it's the best. Mike, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
We're all huge fans. Enjoy Minneapolis these next handful of nights. And if you're ever back in town in the next couple of years, we would love to have you back in and do this again, man. We appreciate the time.
I would love that. And let me know if you want, by the way, it sort of on air or off air. I don't know what this is. Let me know if you guys want me to get you tickets. Just drop me a note. Saturday. Friday, Saturday, by the way, are sold out. Thursday has like 50 tickets.
Right on. We'll pump up tomorrow morning as well.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And I'll see you. Hopefully, maybe I'll see you at the show. And if not, I'll see you next time.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, man.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, Mike Birbiglia, again, Working It Out podcast. You can see him the next three nights at the Pantages if you're seeing this live. Yeah, that dude rules.
He's the best.
I love Birbiglia.
Yeah.
It's just a great guy. And that's him on stage, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like talking to him just now, that's who he is when he's on stage.
And I saw him like 17 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was brilliant.
Man.
Down in Mankato.
And Hawk, we started the podcast with this. This is like the 2 minutes that you missed. But I said the my favorite thing about his podcast is how he laughs at other comics like he's hearing them for the first time. And again, he's known he's known Conan for 20 years.
Sure.
But man, just getting him in a room with another comic and they just freaking love each other, and there's so much respect. It's just so genuine out of him. He just loves joke writers so much.
He loves comedy. You can tell, man.
I'm
just great.
I'm a fan.
I just can't believe those three though, Kroll, Mulaney, and Birbiglia.
Small world.
We're friends, and now they're three of the biggest comedians in the world.
Yep.
Hilarious.
Yep. That dude rules.
Man, that's great.
Sweet.
Well done.
All right.
I'm gonna ask him for tickets. I want to go Saturday night.
Yeah, I might go too.
I actually have nothing to do Saturday.
I love him.
Yeah.
I got neighbors that are going. Why do they get to go and I don't?
Yeah, what are they thinking?
I should go. Right on.
Thank you for your help, Jared.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Jared.
Thank Jared Wells Hope kicks you enjoyed ass. That too. Thanks for getting this technically up and running.
Hit the subscribe button. I think it's right there. Is that the subscribe button?
Yeah, that's it.
Here,
right there. Zach, did you almost fall asleep?
Me? No, I was enjoying the.
No, yeah. That's just his.
I just didn't know where to look. It was weird. You know, I got the.
I don't know what to do with my hands.
And yeah, my hands are.
Yeah.
But
think about, you know, the After Party podcast now has been back for what, a month and a half?
Sure.
And after we took like a 2 or 3 month break, so far, one of the podcasts was 20 minutes of Zach talking about which foods he'd want to fuck.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And then now it's Mike Birbiglia.
It seems like
kind of running the gamut between just. Yeah. An absolute waste of time and then awesomeness.
It's like looking at a 12-year-old's iPhone. Yeah. You just never know what you're going to hear.
Know.
You know, it's going to be bubble guppies. Is that a thing?
Bubble guppies.
Was.
Yeah, not necessarily for 12-year-olds.
And
for sure,
Megadeth.
Megadeth.
Yeah, yeah. On a kid's
iPhone. Zach, any final thoughts?
Well, like, as you were saying, Corey, it takes all kinds of podcasts. It takes the fruit banging ones. Yes. It takes these. It's a great podcast, and we encourage you to hit subscribe for those of you who are new to the show. I know that we might have brought in some Birbiglia fans. Please,
where's the subscribe?
Join
us. But they like clever comedy.
Yeah, they're.
I don't think
they don't
want to
hear you fucking croissant rolls.
Although you and Max,
did you do that?
Much like you were Birbiglia and Conan bonding over their love of joke writing, you and Max did bond over which foods you would want to bang. I felt a similar connection. You know?
Yeah.
I, for one, did not listen to that podcast.
Yeah, so
I
hope
should.
I hope the boss
should go back and check it out.
I'm gonna.
Anyway. Shout out to Birbiglia. He's the best.
That was the best. That was
cool. Yeah, that was great job, Corey.
After Party Podcast.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Subscribe. Bye.
Bye.
Right here is the subscribe button.